Okay, so as I was saying, this is what we did last time, and in 106, we're going to be talking about measurable waves, like sound waves and light waves. So here we have something that's a lot more abstract. The thing that's waving is this thing that we call the wave function psi, and approximately speaking, it's the square root of the probability density, which begs the question, what's the probability density? But that's the probability density over there. More accurately, we would say that the probability density is the magnitude, psi might be a complex number, the magnitude of psi squared. One of the most common things to do with a potential wave function is you're given something like this, and you need to find this factor, overall factor A, which allows for the total probability to be 1. Right? So it's kind of a requirement for the total probability to add up to 1. And that's the answer, what you need for that so-called normalization constant. And it's a pretty common problem in quantum mechanics, given a function f of x to normalize it. Expectation value or average value. So if we have probability density for the location of the particle, we want to make a connection to normal mechanics. We want a position of a particle as opposed to this list of probabilities. Kind of our best bet is to use the average value. And we can calculate the average value by doing that integral. We also want something that's a measurement of kind of the rough size of this distribution. Is the electron pretty well localized or not very well localized? Standard deviation is what we've been using for a long time in order to get the range of possibilities. It's the equation for it is more easily written for the square of the standard deviation, which is called the variance. And I guess it's useful to remember there's kind of a shortcut for this if we actually want to calculate it. So the overall claim of quantum mechanics is that for all of the normal variables that we're used to from mechanics, angular momentum, energy, momentum, position, all those things, there's going to be an operator. And what I mean by an operator is something that takes a function to a function. And kind of a great example of an operator is the derivative function, which changes sines into cosines and things like that. X seems like a pretty wimpy operator, but x times sine is a different function from sine. So it is, in fact, an operator. And here we've got a short list of operators. Doesn't include everything we did in mechanics, but at least it's got some of them there. We're interested in how things change in time in the end, change in location, velocity of particles. The time-dependent Schrodinger equation is the thing that tells us how the wave function changes in time. We're going to be doing integrals like this frequently, where Q is some operator, and this is just a shorthand notation. And it's not clear that we gain a whole lot by it, but at least it doesn't have any, I don't know. They're not a whole lot fewer strokes here than there are there, but it's a pretty common notation. Questions? Okay, so what's the plan for today? Well, we'd like to prove a bunch of theorems. Right? When in doubt, prove some theorems. And we're going to want to also start to deal with the about simplest possible case of standing waves in a box. Okay, so what are the theorems that we're going to be interested in proving? Well, the granddaddy theorem, the theorem that's going to be hidden behind all of these other theorems, is the idea of conservation of probability. That is to say, if we normalize the wave function once, in the future, the total probability will still remain 1, which it has to, right? So if the probability isn't conserved, then, kind of all bets are off. The other theorems that we have allow us to make a connection between quantum mechanics and normal mechanics, right? So if this theory predicts that, you know, this object doesn't fall the way we told you in 191, then we're in trouble, right? Because, you know, for 300 years, people have been making accurate measurements of how things fall, and they keep saying that it's 1/2 AT squared. So this story better reproduce what Galileo said, or else we're in trouble. And what Galileo said, of course, is that the time rate of change in the momentum, ma, was equal to the force. And of course, we know from mechanics that it's usually easier to deal with potential energies. So we need to show something like that if we're going to have some connection to normal mechanics. And if this is going to work, we don't have a momentum, but we do have an average momentum. And similarly, we don't have a force because the particle is at different locations. We have an average force. So we'll prove this, which shows basically that that we can continue to use 1/2 AT squared. And if we care about the time rate of change in momentum, we might as well also concern ourselves with the time rate of change of position. And that just says that velocity is velocity. But of course, now there isn't a position. So what we'd like to be the case is all of that. Okay, so we need to prove these theorems to show that we didn't waste your time in doing mechanics, that this really is all the same thing, as long as the variance and the positions are pretty small. Okay. Well, maybe 2 seconds on standing waves. So if this is going to be a standing wave, and in quantum mechanics, standing waves are also called stationary states, and that's because nothing changes. The standing wave is the same from time to time to time. And if these equations are true, then that gives us some sort of information about what has to be the case, right? So if this is going to be a standing wave, the position can't be changing on average, so the momentum better be zero. And the momentum can't be changing, so that's going to have to tell us that the average value of the force is zero. And we're going to do much more with standing waves, and in the process, we're going to introduce by our friend separation of variables the time independent Schrodinger equation. Okay, so let's try and start. Conservation laws. Well, I think probably our best way of thinking about conservation laws is this conservation law that was very prominent last semester in E&M, and that was conservation of charge. And what we had for conservation of charge, you might remember, was a differential equation. That is, which we called the continuity equation. The time derivative of the charge density plus the divergence of the current density was equal to zero. And if we integrated that out, the charge that was enclosed in some volume, which would be the integral of the charge density with respect to time, if we took the time derivative of that, then according to that equation, what we get is minus the divergence of J dV. And we could switch that around, got by Gauss's theorem, to be minus J dot the surface integral. And so what this says is the only way the charge changes is if there's current flowing through the surface. Okay, so equations like this are equivalent to charge conservation. And so we'd like to show something equivalent to that for probability, and then we'll be all set for probability conservation. Okay, so we know that the thing that's conserved is the probability density, which is psi star psi. And what we need to do is to take the derivative of that with respect to time. And, you know, product rule applies, so this is going to be the time derivative of psi complex conjugated times psi plus psi star time derivative of psi. And we've got formulas for the time derivative of psi that are given to us by the time-independent Schrodinger equation. So that is going to be 1 over I h bar. And that might let me abbreviate all of this stuff, right? Rather than writing all that derivative out every time, let me abbreviate all of that by just with the Hamiltonian h. Okay, so if I plug and chug that through, what I'm going to get that's particularly important is when I take the complex conjugate of that I, I'm going to get a minus sign. So what I'm going to get then is 1 over I h bar times psi star h psi, that's this term here, minus, because of that complex conjugation, h psi star times psi. Okay, well, part of psi is just the real number, excuse me, part of h is the real number v. So if h was just a normal old real number like the potential energy, when I take the complex conjugate of it, I still get v, and so that term is going to cancel out. So really all I have to care about then is the piece of the Hamiltonian that is minus h bar squared over 2m, take two derivatives with respect to x. Okay, so with that cancellation, what we've got is 1 over I h bar. I'm going to use this minus sign to switch this thing around one more time. The h squared over 2m can come out, and then what I'm going to have is two derivatives with respect to x of psi complex conjugated times psi minus psi star, two derivatives with respect to x of psi. Okay? So let me remind you that what we want to write this as is something like the derivative with respect to x of some quantity j. And then that j will be the current that's flowing in the x direction. So let's see if we can do that. Can we write this as a derivative of something given that it's got some second derivatives in it? Well, let's give it a fighting shot. So we have all of this stuff that's going along for the ride. And let me just pull out a derivative, even though it's not going to be quite right, but we'll see how it's going to work. Well, let me put a question mark there. Is something like that going to be true? Well, when the derivative hits that term, we get something that we want. It's looking good. When the derivative hits that term, we get something that's looking good. But we also have these terms where the derivative hits the missing pieces. But if you look at them, they'll exactly cancel. Okay, so what we've, so if we look at what this term is, when it hits this term, we get the derivative with respect to x of psi star times the derivative with respect to x of psi. And when the derivative hits this term, we get exactly the same term. And we got a minus sign to cancel them out. I think I put this h-bar in the wrong spot, right? It was down below before. Kind of jumping the gun. So what I've got then is h-bar over 2mi. And because when I put this term on this side of the equation, I want a minus sign, so I'm going to pull out a minus sign, and then that's going to require me to switch around these orders. So I've got psi star derivative with respect to x of psi minus derivative with respect to x psi star psi. And you might notice h bar over I with that derivative is the momentum operator. But this is the momentum operator that's going one way or the other. Oops, and I also forgot my overall derivative with respect to x. So kind of a shorthand for this is going to be minus the derivative with respect to x of psi star momentum operator going this way and that with a minus sign between them. And then we have an overall factor here of 1 over 2m. And so this quantity here is the current density. Okay, so go ahead.
And the last step one more time.
So
the bottom to the top, right? Or the bottom right up to that.
Yeah, so this is really just notation. Okay. So what I mean about, for example, this thing here, I define that to be A times the derivative of B minus the derivative of A times B.
Okay, so it's that whole inner part.
Yeah, so it's really just rewriting it so that it use fewer symbols and so I can confuse you faster. Okay, so this ugly quantity, which is J, what we've shown then is that the time derivative of psi star psi can be written as minus the derivative with respect to x of whatever that quantity is, j. And just for good practice, let's see how this shows probability conservation. So the total probability is going to be the integral over all space of psi star psi. And so we know that that's going to be minus the integral over all space of the derivative with respect to x of j. And we know from the fundamental theorem of calculus that the integral of the derivative is going to be that thing evaluated plus minus infinity. And I hereby declare that the wave function has to go to zero at infinity. Right? There's only a finite area under it. And if it doesn't go to zero, then it won't be normalizable and it'll all be out. So J has to be zero at both plus and minus infinity. So this thing is going to be zero. This was the time derivative. Okay. So again, if you want kind of an interpretation of J, here's X and here's a region A and a region B. If we look at the probability that the particle is between A and B, how could that change? That could change because probability is coming in at this end, and it could change because probability is leaving at that end. And this J is exactly the probability that's flowing at any particular point X. If you want to see that kind of for sure, let's look at the probability that it's between A and B, the time rate of change of it. And so what we're going to get now, oops, this was B and this was A. So what we're going to get then is J at A minus J at B. Current that's the time rate of change in the probability between A and B is the probability that's flowing in at A minus the probability that's flowing out at B. Okay, so this is one step more abstract than it was last semester, right? There we had charge, which you could actually measure. Now we have this kind of abstract idea of probability. But, you know, mathematically, probability has to be conserved. It has to add up to one. And so, even though it's more abstract, it's just as much there. Okay. Well, so let's take a look at proof for this equation. So the average value of x, expectation value, is the integral of psi star x psi. And we usually tend to write the operator between, but just, I think it'll be a little bit clearer if in this particular instance I separate them out. So if I want the time derivative of the average value of x, that is to say, average value of x is where we're saying kind of the particle is if we have to. So we're looking for how that position is changing in time. So Leibniz theorem says that full derivatives outside of an integral become partial derivatives inside of an integral. And here's maybe the trick to remember, x and t are totally independent variables, right? I can choose any time and any location. They're not related. So the derivative does not hit that term. It just hits that term. Okay, and we have shown that that term is given by that term. So what we've got here is the integral of x times minus the derivative with respect to x of, and I think I'll probably write this p thing, psi star p going this way or that way times psi. Oops, and I have my 1 over 2m. Okay, so we're starting to get things that look a little bit right, right? I wanted the expectation value of p. And of course, what that would be the integral of psi star and then that p operator psi. But I do have some derivatives and things which maybe aren't looking exactly appropriate. And I have that factor of 2, which isn't present in what I want. Well, are all those things going to work out? Well, the first thing we have going for us is integration by parts. So you know that the integral of f times the derivative with respect to x of g dx is equal to, and we might as well prove this theorem, it's equal to the derivative with respect to x of f times g minus the derivative with respect to x times g, all of that dx. This is, I'm sure you did this in calculus. Here we have the integral of the derivative, so this is going to be f times g evaluated between the endpoints. And we have minus the derivative with respect to x of f times g. Okay, familiar stuff.
I got lost right now. Are we just doing integration by parts right now?
I'm about to do integration by parts for this, but I just proved integration by parts again, lest you've forgotten it. So this term here, the wave function has to go to zero at infinity, so that term there is going to be zero. So in this particular case, of course, f is equal to x and g is equal to j. And so what we're left up with is an overall minus sign. That'll kill that minus sign. And the derivative of x of x is just one. So I have psi star p going this way and that way times psi. Okay, so now what happens to this? So if I didn't have this 2 and I didn't have this double arrow, I'd be doing good, right? right? Because I want to show this, but I've got a factor of 2, and this is actually 2 terms, remember. Okay, so then we have a little lemma that solves that problem for us. What we're going to show is that the integral of p, this is the operator p, operating on f times g, is equal to f pg. And if we've got that, then our 2 terms, the 2 will cancel and we'll have what we want. Okay, so let's check this out. So this thing here, remember that p is h bar over I derivative with respect to x. So when I take the complex conjugate of this I get minus. And now I can do the integration by parts trick that we just talked about. So this is plus, and then the integral of f times the derivative with respect to x of g. And this is, of course, exactly p. Okay, so whether the p's on this side or the other side, we get exactly the same result. And that cancels this 2. So this is 1 over m, the integral of psi star p psi dx. And that's exactly what we wanted to show. Okay, so maybe that's enough fun with proof. The proof of that guy, I guess I'm not sure it is in the book. It might be a homework problem. But on to other issues. Questions on those guys? We're good? So again, the purpose for these is to make connections with classical mechanics. Expectation values, given that the particle is actually spread out and has a range of momentas, if we have to make a connection, we're going to use the expectation value, and then this is exactly what we would get from quantum mechanics. Okay, standing waves. So what we have is the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And I'll write it out in gory detail this once again. So this is not an ordinary differential equation. This is a partial differential equation because it's got derivatives of 2 different types, right? Time and space. And when we solved partial differential equations last semester, we did it kind of hopefully by separation of variables. That is to say, we assumed that the answer was a product of something that was just a function of one variable times a function of the other variable. Okay, so I'm going to make this notation maybe seem a little bit funny. The original version of psi, let me call it a double-barreled thing. So psi double bar, it's a function of both space and time. But I'm going to assume that it's some function of time times some function of space. So just as we said last time in E&M, this seems like a crazy assumption. There are lots of functions that can't be written in that form. But we said there that in the end, it turns out that by taking linear combinations of these things, you can write any old function this way. Okay, so that's the hopeful ansatz. If I find a t and a psi that work, then it will work for the original equation. The question is whether I've actually captured any large number of the solutions of the original equation. And the claim is that I have, that completeness will give us that. Okay, so if I plug this possibility into this equation, what I've got then is I h bar. The only place I take time derivatives is of capital T, and the one barred psi goes along for the ride. These are all stuff that just depend on x, so the t is going to go along for the ride. And now we do the usual thing, divide both sides by psi, double barred psi, that is to say t times psi. So what I've got here is I h bar t prime over t, and what I've got over here is 1 over psi minus h bar squared over 2m psi double prime plus v times psi. So the left-hand side is just a function of time. The right-hand side is just a function of x. How can something be simultaneously a function just of time and just of space? Well, the only possibility is if it is a constant. And I am very suggestively going to call that constant E. So that leads one differential equation that is easy to solve. I h bar t prime wants to equal that constant times t. And I don't know, that's something that we can solve by whatever your favorite method is, but there's the answer. When I take the derivative, the minus I comes down, and because I times minus I is equal to 1, what I get is just the E h bar. The h bars cancel, and I get that. The other differential equation isn't so easy to solve, so we're going to give it a famous dead physicist's name. So it is that E psi is equal to minus h bar squared over 2m psi double prime plus the potential energy times psi. Okay, so this is the time independent, no time in here, Schrodinger equation. And it's actually what we're going to be spending most of our time on. No pun intended. And we can still write that as h psi just to save a whole bunch of keystrokes. Okay, so the difference between the time-independent Schrodinger equation and the time-dependent Schrodinger equation is just what's here, right? If this is a constant times psi, then we are in the time-independent. If that is the time derivative, then we're talking about the time-dependent. And 90% of the time in this class, we'll be dealing with the time-independent Schrodinger equation. Okay. Well, when in doubt, invent notations and words. So this thing that's like h, that's an operator, right? And psi is a function. And what Schrodinger's equation says is that when the operator operates on that function, we just get a multiple of what we started with. Now, I told you three months ago, that you can think about functions as being kind of like vectors, and then operators are kind of like matrices, right? Because a matrix takes a vector to a vector. So the equivalent statement would be that a matrix times a vector is a constant times the vector. And 2 years ago, I'm sure you all remember, you dealt with this sort of thing, I hope, all the time. This was probably called an eigenequation, although it might have been called a characteristic equation from linear algebra. So an eigenequation is where an operator operates on something and it gives you back just a constant times the thing that you started with. The constant that you get is called an eigenvalue. Because this eigenvalue is the energy, we might call it the eigenenergy. Doesn't matter. And I repeat, Just if you look, I'm not sure what you did in linear algebra, but so Eigen is the German word for self, and since we're Americans, some people like to get rid of the German. So some books would call that not any physics books. Some mathematics books would call that characteristic. Okay. So far, so good. Okay, so that's what a stationary wave is. A stationary wave is one that is of this form, where the whole wave function is e to the minus I h bar energy times time divided by h bar times a function of position. And the reason it's called a stationary state is if we calculate any expectation value, right? So if I take any old operator, and I take my psi and my operator and my psi, this quantity is going to cancel out when I do the psi star psi, right? Because I'll get e to the minus I times e to the plus I, and they'll cancel out. So this quantity will exactly equal that quantity, and that quantity has no time in it, and therefore it has no time derivative. So the expectation value of any physical operator is constant in a stationary state, which is to say in a standing wave.
What does it say in the exponent of the e that's circled there?
So it's e to the minus energy, e times time, divided by h bar. And since you see that, I mean, obviously it would be nice to define energy divided by h bar as omega, and then we'd have e to the minus I omega t, which looks familiar. And if we do that, if we think about that, so e equals h bar omega, h bar is the Planck's constant divided by 2 pi, and the angular frequency is 2 pi times the frequency, and in modern, e equals hf, I bet, was something that you wrote a lot. Okay. Oh, well, can't do as much in 55 minutes as you can do in 7 minutes. So let's take a look at the simplest quantum mechanics problem, which is called the square well problem. And we're going to do the infinite square well problem, at least first. And what we're imagining is, here's the real line, the set of all possible locations. I'm going to put an impenetrable barrier here at 0, and I'm going to put an impenetrable barrier here at L. You know, so think of this kind of like the bumpers of a billiard board table. So classically, of course, what happens is if I put something in there with some kinetic energy, it's going to just bounce back and forth forever. So how does that same thing work for quantum mechanics? Well, for an infinite square well, this is impenetrable, so there has to be zero probability that it's behind the impenetrable wall. So the only place we can find the particle is between 0 and L. And we might as well, since there's no force, we might as well take the potential to be 0 at this location. So what Schrodinger's equation says is that minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives with respect to x on psi, plus the potential, which is 0 times psi, that has to equal the energy times psi. And so that leads to, you know, the most famous differential, well, I don't know, is it the most famous? Certainly one of the most famous differential equations, where two derivatives gives you is you minus what you started with. And this is just a constant, right? And it takes a lot of keystrokes. So let me call that constant k squared. So what we have then is minus two derivatives with respect to x of psi is equal to k squared times psi. And you know that the solution of this are sines and cosines, right? This is sine of kx, or it's cosine of kx, or some linear combination of the two. Now the wave function has to be zero at zero, so it can't be cosine. And the wave function has to be zero at x equals l. So it must be that k times l has to be some integer number of pi's, because then the sine of kl will equal to zero. Okay, so that's our first wave function. Psi is equal to sine of kx, where if you ask me what k is, it's the square root of 2m times the energy divided by h bar. And it also has to be an integer number of pi's. So n would be 1, 2, 3, etc. So the possible energies of this particle are, well, if we write it in terms of k, it's h bar squared k squared over 2m. If I write k in terms of pi, this is h bar squared pi squared over 2m times n squared. So the lowest possible energy corresponds to n equals 1, and then we have n equals 2, which is going to be 4 times higher. And we're going to have n equals 3, that's going to be 9 times higher. So we have energies slash frequencies that are not integer multiples of, well, they are integer multiples, but they're the squares of integer multiples related to each other. Unlike the standing waves on a string, which they were 1, 2, 3. So here they're 1, 4, 9 in terms of their frequencies. Well, this isn't normalized. So if we normalize this, we're going to have the square root of 2 of, yes. We're going to, it turns out that that's what we need in order to normalize it. Minutes becomes 70 minutes by just ignoring the clock. Let me talk about notational difference. So the book is going to call that final point A. And, oh, that's a pretty trivial difference. It turns out that very frequently, we're going to want to take the origin symmetrically at the center. And so what I'm going to do under those circumstances is call this A and minus A. So I apologize for choosing a different notation from the book, but I think it'll be okay. So for the time being, the length of the square well is L. We're not going to have any symmetric, unsymmetrical choices. I'll quit at roughly 55 minutes. 55 for big 55.
Just one more time. What is this problem again?
Like, wait. I've got 5 more minutes. Don't I?
You have until 10:05.
I have 10:05. Oh, okay. Good.
What is this problem again? The particle just moving back and forth.
Yeah, so we have impenetrable walls, and we have a particle that's confined between those walls. So if it has any kinetic energy, it's just going to bounce back and forth.
And what we're measuring, what?
Well, if we know psi, we know everything. Psi by itself is basically the probability density, at least if you square it. And we also know what the energy is of this system. So there's a minimum amount of energy. It can't have less energy than when I plug in n equals 1 into this formula.
And what is the equation for psi? How do we know what psi is?
So what psi is in general is this probability density. And the way we figure it out is by the Schrodinger equation.
Okay.
And this was the Schrodinger equation. Usually there'd be a potential here, but it's a flat bottom thing, right? There's no potential, so we just have zero. So we had this differential equation, which just rearranging and calling these constants different things is that differential equation. And that differential equation is pretty common. It has sines and cosines as its solutions. And in particular, since it can't be to the left of these impenetrable walls, it has to be zero. The wave function has to be zero at here and here. So of course, I mean, you know what the sine function looks like. So in terms of the wave function itself, you know, we'd have that sort of situation. Remember that the probability density is psi squared. So this thing would look, well, you know what it's going to look like, right? It's going to have peaks, whether the psi is positive or negative. So peaks there, peaks there, peaks there, peaks there, peaks there. So it's kind of like fringes. That is to say, there are spots where the particle, nodes where the particle would never be found. It would only be found frequently in these locations.
And so the more energy it has, the more peaks there are, right?
The more energy it has, the more peaks it has. So there's a relationship between the wavelength and the energy. So more peaks means smaller wavelength, which means more energy.
Now, I probability of zero being spot, it's going to be there at some point.
I was about to say that that's a frequently asked question. How can it be, if the particle is going back and forth, that it could be have zero possibility of going between? Well, that's the way waves work, right? That's the unhappy answer.
Because it's not actually just like bouncing back and forth between there. It's like an electron like doing its weird stuff.
So it is an electron doing its weird stuff, but if you have to apply normal words to what that weird stuff is, it's bouncing back and forth between those walls. So it's simultaneously going in both directions at the same time. And as a result of interference, there are spots where it can't be. Because it has to be doing all of this stuff at the same time. See, it can't literally be going this way and that way, because then there would be a changing momentum. So the momentum has to be, the average momentum has to be zero, which means that it's going left and right at the same time. It's a standing wave. Well, it's not okay, but it is the way it is. We have this unfortunate fact that the way things are is not the way we experience them, so it kind of doesn't make sense. But it is just like any other standing wave you've thought of, right? The standing waves that we have on a string, we told you, those were waves that were going this way simultaneously, but there it is, there's a node, the string has zero position and velocity at that spot. So how can the string be going both this way and that way and in fact not be moving?
So why does it have to be doing everything at once? So the graph, is the x-axis is position, or?
Yeah, the x-axis is position.
Okay.
And the y-axis is probability density, right? So kind of where the particle is.
And then time has what?
Time is not in here, because we're in the time independent Schrodinger equation. But if we bring back the time dependence, it doesn't change any of this picture, because the probability density would be psi star psi, and this factor would cancel out. So these standing waves are stationary states. Nothing changes.
Only in a standing wave situation. Could you do this bounded well with a non-standing wave?
So it has to be the case that, you know, if I make this well, you know, a meter long, and I put one of these balls in there, it must be that quantum mechanics would say that this probability could be seen to be bouncing back and forth, that the lump would be here, and then it 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 would reflect back.
But is there such a thing as, like, where it wouldn't set up a standing wave, and it would actually, like, the wave would be you know, like on a string, if you don't have the right length or frequency, it's not going to set up a standing wave. It's going to just like move around, like wobble.
Yes, but I think that's also what I said, so I'm a little bit worried. So let me say what I said again and try and convince you that it's the same thing that you're saying. So it has to be the case that there are solutions for macroscopic systems, if I make L big enough and the mass is big enough, that we would have a lump of probability, and that lump of probability would move with time, and it would reflect off this wall and it would come back. So how can it be that we can have things that don't depend on time become things that do depend on time? That's the magic of superposition. So it turns out that if I take a superposition of standing waves, I can make something that looks like this. And you might have, so that's a kind of a surprising fact that you might have talked about last semester with boundary value problems. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. So let's just talk about strings. So you know, kind of the way you typically think about strings is in terms of standing waves, right? Because that's what we always talk about in physics, right? So there's a fundamental, there's the next harmonic, etc. But it must be that there is a solution to a string where I pluck it and this plucking bounces back and forth. How can it be that this is that? And the answer is superposition. By taking a superposition of standing waves, I can make a little packet that just bounces back and forth. And it consists then of lots of harmonics. So by taking superpositions of these standing waves, I can make things that change in time. It turns out, and we'll be doing a lot of that, but it turns out that kind of practically speaking, that's usually not so important, because the time dependence is so fast for kind of real systems like atoms that you wouldn't see it anyway. That the only thing you ever kind of really experience are these standing waves. I don't know if we're happy with that or not.
Yeah, so I get the probability density graph, but then with the psi graph, what does that mean again exactly?
So the probability density is just psi squared.
Yes. And so, but in the graph of just psi, with the sine wave, it's position and energy, or what is it?
It's psi.
It's psi.
The units are one over the square root of length. It's not a very physical thing. So the probability density, so it's kind of, we're in an unusual situation in that what the physics gives us is not something that's directly measurable, psi. What is directly measurable is psi squared.
Okay, so psi doesn't really mean anything.
Well, I'm not upset if you think that, but it's not really true. So just as you might say that the voltage isn't really important, it's really the electric field that causes forces.
Oh.
But yeah, you know, but the voltage really is kind of important. But what is true is that the only thing you could, well, even this is not exactly true, but I'll say it anyway, that the psi is basically not measurable, or at least not easily measurable. It's the probability density that is relatively easy to measure. So we have this kind of funny situation where we can have psi that is fundamentally wavy because its real and imaginary parts are changing, but the probability density doesn't show any of that waviness. And that's kind of what's happening here, right? So here we have something that is oscillating, but it cancels out in any quantity, and so we get things that are stationary. It's all tricky.